Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Why aren't there better leaders coming out of our political class? We started thinking about this show when we got a call from Rich and Arden Hills, who wondered why politicians couldn't be more receptive, more thoughtful about ideas from outside of their political sphere.
Can you point to some people in public life who actually do seem to listen to each other or to other people to understand and then take benefit and do something from it?
Okay, so Rich's call is informing the show. And as noted, I want you to think about this. What are the leadership qualities that you think are missing from our political leaders? Do you think about humility, clarity, selflessness, leadership qualities that we wish more of our political leaders possessed? And maybe there's someone in politics, past or present, who really exemplifies those qualities for you. So I'd like to think about the best of our qualities that we wish the political class exemplified. What are they? Is there someone who is a great example of that? 800-242-2828, 651-227-6000, on Twitter at Carrie NPR, where Paul says perhaps the natural selection process is skewing towards people who seek the limelight and don't want to upset the group think, much less take a vote on principle that will cost them their job. I think Paul might have something there. Let's get our guests in on the conversation, and then I want to hear from you. Kenesha Grand is assistant professor of political science at Howard University, and she's with us today from Washington, D.C. Kenesha, welcome. Really good to have you on the show.
Thank you so much for the invitation.
And Jay Iyer is with us. He's an assistant professor of public policy at Texas Southern University and host of the Party Politics podcast. And he's with us today from Houston. And Jay, welcome to you. Good to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, Kenesha, I wonder what you think of Paul's tweet there about, you know, are we in a system here where it's really about people who seek the limelight, don't want to upset the groupthink, and don't want to put political capital on the line to take a vote that isn't going to be popular? Too cynical, or might he have something there?
I think somewhere in between a bit of cynicism and he has it right.
Okay.
I think it's the case that politicians are trying to get reelected. And these days, it's the best way to get reelected is to take the position of the folks who are on the left or the extreme right. We see less and less moderates. And even among independents, we see people who are leaning hard left or leaning hard right. So in some instances, it's the case that politicians are taking positions or want to take positions that make sense, that are good and right, but they want to get reelected too. And sometimes those moderate positions don't really help them in their reelection bids.
You know, Jay, this is something that I was just talking to Ken Rudin about, and we were talking about the Northam situation in Virginia. And I suggested that if he was going to put the good of the people, the good of the office, the good of the state first, would he be agonizing about whether to step down? It is clear that he's lost the moral authority, at least for now, to govern. Is that a fair example, do you think, where high principles of leadership are failing?
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right. I think the issue you have in the case of Ralph Northam is what you see a lot with politicians, is that they have spent, in many cases, years and years trying to achieve a particular position. They are reluctant to leave, even in the face of obvious opposition and the evidence that the public they've lost the confidence of the public, or at least their sliver of the public that supports them. So the most interesting sort of example, I think, sort of maybe the opposite of this, is how quickly, for example, Al Franken left office. There was probably far greater numbers of individuals trying to tell him to stay on and fight on, rather than, as opposed to what the situation you have with Ralph Northam.
Yeah, but,
so Yeah.
But Jay, I mean, we have discussed the Franken situation a lot here. You know, as Ken suggested, in that moment, I have to say, I thought Al Franken made a decision that didn't just represent his own ambition. He could have hung on. That was right. For the good of the party, maybe for the good of the Senate, and needed to be done. I think he exemplified some high principles of leadership.
I do.
You don't?
And
you
that's
do.
That's exactly
okay.
My point.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree with you 100% on that. And I think that sort of, you know, what probably makes someone like Franken different is that he was relatively new to the political process. He had a certain level of fame and notoriety before getting into politics. And I wonder sometimes about the political process itself. It has a tendency, politicians, you know, what they used to say, I think the phrase was politics was act. It was show business for ugly people. There's a level of narcissism involved in individuals seeking office. And so oftentimes what you'll find with any sort of anyone who sort of has those kind of traits is that there's a tendency to want to stay on even in the
right.
midst of scandal.
Right.
You see this in celebrity journalists, folks like Matt Lauer and Charlie Rose, et cetera, doing similar things in the face of obvious scandal. They want to fight on. They want to push through. And you're seeing some of that with Ralph Northam.
Yeah, good point. Let me grab a call here from John in Perham. Hi, John. How are you thinking about this?
Well, they've begun to talk about some of the things that I wanted to mention. You know, as I see it, there's a lack of leadership. We need people who have the courage to say what they think and to educate the public and to lead the public instead of the sort of political paranoia that focuses mostly on reelection. So that's what the point that I wanted to make. And the problem is that the electorate votes. Does not vote for courageous politicians.
Yeah, I mean,
we're bringing the problem on ourselves.
I'm glad you brought this up, John. Kanisha, this is something that I was talking to Ken about, and I just brought up Social Security. I think John's got something there with we want leaders who will take us potentially down paths that might be difficult. And that is changing. You know, sometimes that's making fundamental kind of changes to the system. But it's risky, right?
It's absolutely risky. And I think one of the things I was thinking about in your conversation earlier was that many people in the electorate don't recognize the space between politics and governing. And so the feelings and emotions that you need to feel in order to be kind of good in an election, to turn out to vote and to support your candidate, are not the same emotions that you need to be good at governing. So I think the caller has a great point.
It's
incumbent upon politicians to educate the public to say, listen, I would really love to get you a border wall, but this is what it's going to take to get a border wall, right? Like, I'm not going to promise you a border wall that somebody else is going to pay for. I'm going to tell you that I'm going to get you a border wall and explain exactly what it takes to get that border wall or what it takes to get immigration or any of the other things that people in the electorate believe are important.
Joe says on Twitter, I believe the degree to which political leaders have diminished in exemplifying leadership qualities is correlated to the increase in time they must devote to fundraising. The endless quest for funds undermines politicians' ability to be independent agents. He might have something there. To Renee in South St. Paul. Hi, Renee. Well, where do you come down on this? Okay. To Barry in St. Paul. Hey, Barry. Hey, if we miss your call, call us back. We have a lot of calls coming in and the lines are busy. So, Renee, if you wanted to get on, call back. To Barry in St. Paul.
Yeah,
hi, Barry.
Good morning. I'd like to let us look back to Arne Carlson when he was governor of Minnesota. He was not the Republican endorsed candidate.
Yep, that's right.
And when he ran, he brought us Minnesota Care, which now is considered socialized medicine. He looked at the bus strike in Minneapolis and a lot of low-income folks, and he said, if they strike, I'll organize school buses. And again, when the Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe won their treaty case in the Supreme Court, even though the state went against the Mille Lacs Band, he said there won't be violence in the boat landings in Minnesota like there was in Wisconsin. And this is coming from a Republican governor at a time when you had the Newt Gingrich rebellion in the House. And he did a lot of things that we would now consider democratic.
That's a really good point. And he ticked off a lot of people in his party. And he knew that, right, Barry? Remember when he'd show up at the conventions? You know, he got an earful from Republicans.
He did. And And when he could, he was easily electable for a third term. I'm full disclosure, I'm a left-leaning progressive. Mm-hmm. He could have ran again for a third term, and he stopped. And he said, nobody should serve longer than the president of the United States. And I just admire that. I admire that.
Thanks for the call, Barry. Jay, I wondered if you think our ideas of political leadership, you know, what it is when we see it, have changed. Because I was thinking about, you know, some of the most revered political leaders, history, FDR, Eisenhower, Washington, there was a kind of paternalistic quality to their leadership. We, I think, as a people want something else. So have our ideas about what good leadership is changed?
Well, I think it tends to fall under two categories. One, I think you're right about sort of the paternalistic aspect or the leadership style that overcomes a particular tragedy or economic occurrence in the case of FDR. The other side of it is sort of the counter-programming element, right? We tend to admire sort of the whole concept of profiles and courage. Part of the appeal, whether it's deserved or not, of the late John McCain was that he was known as a maverick politician. Mm-hmm. The caller just referenced Arne Carlson. Again, another maverick politician that received criticism from members of his own party. That's what we've historically kind of admired when we talk about kind of broad leadership skills. And the political process itself is increasingly creating a much more homogenous politician that tends to be much more strident in terms of kind of their partisan perspective, right? Republicans are more conservative than at any point in previous time. Democrats, for the most part, are more liberal or progressive than at any point in their previous time. And the leadership part of it comes from being able to get people who don't necessarily agree with you to agree with you. And that's the art of it. And I think we have huge systemic problems. Some of it's driven from the electoral process itself, the primary process itself, I think the one caller had mentioned the need to raise money on a nonstop pace. But I think by and large, that's what's creating this situation. We have a system that, by lack of another word, just is polarized, structurally polarized.
Right.
And that, I think, is what's fueling some of this.
Jay called to say from Wayzata, we need to take a lesson from Congressman Tim Penny, who warned us when he left Congress that if you aren't a member of the club coming in, you will ultimately become part of the club. This is the problem. You know, Kanisha, I was thinking about this, and I'm really looking forward to the conversations we're going to have about gender and leadership, right? What leadership looks like when it isn't in the form of a white man.
Right.
Because I think a lot of women are held up to a different standard when it comes to exemplifying leadership. And this is going to be a great cycle to be talking about that. So how do you think about it?
I think women are absolutely held to a different standard when we think about all of the things that they do, when we think about like what they look like and what they say and kind of what they are able to get away with and how we counterbalance that against what white men are able to do. I think the literature tells us in political science that the way women govern is just different than the way men govern. They are usually more concerned about compromise, usually more open and receptive to information. And I think that comes from, for women, and for potentially some minority groups, comes from a disadvantaged place in our society where you're not allowed to kind of be in the world not listening to other people. You're not allowed to kind of be in the world without compromise, forcing your position. You don't really get things done that way. And so we see that women and minorities show up in these chambers and show up in ways that would probably be good for all leaders because they allow more information to come in. They allow more compromise.
You know, I'm also thinking about what Jay said about persuasion, how that is such a necessary and I'd say highest principle of leadership. And that doesn't mean hammering people until they give in. I think so many of our, and I think we see this, so many of our political leaders have lost or never had that art of persuasion. It's from the word go, it's you're never going to agree with me anyway, so you don't mean anything. Right. And, you know, and that's kind of where we've ended up.
I think you're right about that. I think that leaders come to their positions. And we think a lot about president and Congress, but I'm glad the caller talked about the governor, because I think there's some really good political leadership happening at the state and local level that we don't think about often. But I think folks come to these positions doing what worked for them in the past. And so if it's the case that you were a state legislature and your whole time in the state legislature was built on you being kind of brash and crudish and not compromising with people, the likelihood that you're going to show up in Congress or that you're going to show up for the White House or the governor's seat behaving that same way is great. And I think that some of what we have to do is kind of be very thoughtful about what's happening at the state and local level and check folks when they behave badly at that point, so that we don't have to deal with them on a national scale later.
Kenesha Grant is one of our guests this morning as we talk about leadership qualities that we want to see and so often are missing in our political class. She's an assistant professor of political science at Howard University. And Jay Iyer is with us, an assistant professor of public policy at Texas Southern University. He hosts the Party Politics podcast. Sounds interesting, Jay. I'm going to have to tune into that.
Yes, please do.
I will do. So I'm asking to hear from you about those leadership qualities, decisiveness, persuasion, selflessness, clarity. What would you put at the top of those principles? And then how do you analyze why, what's, we voters have a role in this, and what has happened that we see those, so often those qualities missing? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. Marianne says on Twitter, moral leadership in U.S. would promote accountability and reconciliation without a rush to judgment. Desmond Tutu and the South African Reconciliation Commission found a way to do this. And Marianne, I was just in South Africa, so that really resonates with me. They did. To Laura in Bloomington. Hey, Laura, hi. Thanks for waiting.
Hi, no problem. I think that what we're missing in a lot of our leadership is the ability to step out of one's own shoes and to step into the realities of life in a life that isn't yours and isn't that of those around you. A lot of leaders are upper class. They have a lot more money. They have a lot more access to things than people. And being able to step back and realize that those don't come as easily to everyone and have that base compassion and empathy for others, I think that's something that's really missing.
Boy, Laura, great comment. Jay, I couldn't agree with that more. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I agree. I think perspective is something that's certainly lacking. I mean, there's a great story, you know, former Congressman Jack Kemp, who by all accounts was a very conservative, fiscally conservative congressman from the Buffalo, New York area, speaks passionately, I think, about his interaction in the as a football player and interacting with African Americans and how that impacted his perspective on things. We live in very siloed societies. It's increasingly more siloed. There's very little interaction, not just from a race or ethnic perspective, but more often than not, purely socioeconomic. We tend to group that way, and that really drives the entire perspective. And for elected officials and politicians, particularly ones that are trying to raise money, oftentimes from high income people, that's the only perspective they often hear. Interest groups that are right. That are supporting these candidates. That's the perspective they hear. I absolutely agree with the caller. That is something that is missing in our politics today.
You know, I want to throw a name into the mix, and not for the obvious reasons. John Lewis comes to mind. Now, yes, a civil rights leader, weathered violence, discrimination, and rejection, but and exemplified these wonderful qualities of leadership in the toughest situations. But he also came to mind for me because he has been doing the most determined, hard work in the legislature, in the House, for, 30-some years. I mean, the determination and resilience to continue to push against the system. I think from one side, that looks like, oh, he just wants to get reelected. You know, that looks like, oh, maybe we need term limits. But I look at that and say, there were times when this was the most difficult of work, and he prevailed, right? Kanisha, I wonder what you think of that logic.
I think you're absolutely right. One of the things that John Lewis makes me think about and that I would encourage others to try to think about is a kind of why leaders choose to do their work. Right. Why do people get into politics?
Right.
And in the kind of cult of personality we have going on in American politics today, where you have 24-hour access to people via social media and television, it's, I think, easier for folks to get involved in politics because it's glorious, because
right.
it looks great.
Right.
Whereas a person like John Lewis is getting involved in politics because he wants to solve a problem. He wants to end discrimination in America. And so that might be occurring over the course of 30 years, but it occurs in various ways. And he's able to sit on the floor at night, you know, and not eat and take a stand because he is working to solve a problem. He didn't come there for the fame or for the glory. He came to solve a problem. And when a person is working to solve a problem, how they govern and how they lead is going to look very different from a person who shows up because they kind of want to be cool and want to be on the scene.
Wow, that's exactly right. To the phones to Renee in St. Paul. Hey, Renee, I'm glad you called back. What'd you want to say?
There are really two things for me. And the first one is I really believe that our leaders now just kind of go with the philosophy of the end justifies the means, that they will say anything or do anything to get what they want. And I think the government shutdown is a big part of that. To me, that's proof of that. You know, whose purpose did that really serve other than to try to get them what they wanted? And then the second thing is really this unwillingness anymore to compromise. You know, how many times have you heard newly elected people say, oh, I have this mandate or we have this mandate, when really either in the Senate or Congress that they don't even have like a huge majority. And yet they feel like they've come in on this wave and of what things need to get done because they have a mandate from this people. And there rarely has been, I mean, how many elections are there where it's like 90-10, right? So even if it's like a 60-40, you still represent that other 40% of the population.
Right.
And so I don't understand what they're thinking. I do understand what they're thinking. They need to get reelected. And to me, that's why I'm just a more advocate of term limits now, because I don't want that to be their concern. I want them to represent the people, all of the people.
You've said some interesting things, Renee. I don't know if you heard our story or our show with Liliana Mason, the political scientist from the University of Maryland. Her book is called On Civil Agreement. And when you were talking about this, Jay, Renee, when she says the unwillingness to compromise, I think we see that play out. The shutdown's a great example. And yet, these politicians are responding to the fact that we as voters have become more tribal, too. I mean, they're taking their cues in some ways from an electorate that sends them from a tribal electorate that sends them there to do this and then says, but compromise when necessary.
Yeah, I know the electorate often sends mixed messages in the sense that, we can certainly use this shutdown as probably the most obvious recent example. But, the easy thing to do for Democrats in many ways would be to compromise, build, part of the wall, give the president what he wants, and in exchange get some sort of comprehensive immigration reform that their base wants. But
mm-hmm.
that is an unsavory result, almost entirely based on the fact that they don't want to give the wall. They don't want the president to have a wall based on principle. And so oftentimes we celebrate leadership that is really predicated on the notion of compromise and sort of a centrism kind of ideal. And then we think about leadership in terms of holding steadfast to a guiding principle. A lot of that is perspective.
I know
I may not agree with a particular position, but I can admire individuals that sort of want to stand firm on something. The same people that sort of are critical of the president or others who are conservative on this on the issue of the wall are the same people that would probably be equally strident on the other side saying we cannot have a wall.
Okay, this
so,
is this is yeah. Well,
so
Jay,
so it's, So it's interesting.
Yeah. Well, I just, if you'd hold right there, because Kanisha, Jay has just laid out the duality of this and why this is so difficult. You know, holding firm on a principle looks like great leadership until it shuts down the government. I mean, that's, I think, what is so difficult about a conversation in the kind of political arena we're in right now.
Yeah, I think he's right. The holding great looks great until people can't buy groceries, right? But I think it's incumbent upon leaders, and kind of the political science professor in me wants to say it's incumbent upon the electorate to understand where the boundaries of this stuff exist. Mm-hmm. And so I'll say that I am a left-leaning Democrat and was excited that the Democrats did not fold on this issue of the wall. But I also recognize that the way our government is organized and the way keeping the government is set up, there was going to be some negotiation at some point, and that negotiation is probably going to look like border security. That's not a wall. And so I think that it's incumbent upon leaders to lead, where leading means that sometimes they have to educate people. And I don't think the Democrats or the Republicans in this instance did a good job of that, because I don't think they were clear with their voters, like, yes, we're taking this principal position, we're doing this because we want to lead and be great for you, mm-hmm. but let us tell you how this really works and what we're really going to have to do to get this thing accomplished.
Matthew says on Twitter, wealthy donors and corporate interests send candidates to public office to vote for one or two key measures that have financial implications for those donors, not for their leadership skills. Surprises me that this has escaped the conversation this far. Jay, do you agree with that analysis of how money works in politics? Is it that simple?
I mean, certainly, if you look at who gives and who to members of Congress and whose voices are heard, I think Matthew's point is certainly has a lot of salience. You know, disproportionately, if you look at just from a data perspective, politicians are beholden to the people who give them money, whether directly or indirectly. And you see that over and over again with interest groups that continue to pour money in. The flip side of that, I'm sorry, the corollary to that is that they're also beholden to individuals who can move segments of a primary electorate.
Yeah.
That's one of the reasons why, for example, the positions on things like gun control are so extreme on in many ways on both sides of political discourse because of who is providing that energy. You see the same thing in terms of abortion rights. And so the system essentially is structured so that you have interests that kind of funnel dollars at the primary level at the edges, and that's what creates the circumstance we have. To Matthew's point, corporations and business interests are the dominant contributing force in terms of money in the system.
Casey adds, I believe one reason politicians are so partisan is due to how the election system is set up. For many, they don't have to win the general, only their primary. Yeah, that's true in a lot of cases. And to Dave in Rochester. Hi, Dave.
Yeah, good morning. I think it'd be nice if we could end the culture war and go back to governing the country and stop electing people who tell us what we want to hear. My example is the evangelicals voted for Trump, and he had nothing in common with them, really. It's time to get on with leading, find the center, and get to work on it.
Okay, so let me take your example, because, Kanisha, there's been a lot of writing and reporting on what it was that evangelical voters found to like about President Trump. It appears that it was an agenda that he was very open about, to put Supreme Court judges on the court that agreed with many of the positions that evangelicals hold on issues like abortion.
Yeah, I think that our participation as people in groups and sometimes as individuals run counter to these desires that we have to have leaders who have wonderful qualities and moral positions. And so in the case of the Christian evangelicals, they have one thing that they are seeking that we hear about most often, and that's ending abortion. That's protection of life, as they would call it. And so they are thinking about, in this entire set of people, who is going to deliver that promise, who is going to deliver a justice who supports their position. And they vote for Donald Trump not necessarily depending on who it is, because they believe that he's a wonderful person, but because they have one political issue and they are seeking to get that one political issue handled, just like the wealthy donor has one political issue or potentially two that they are seeking to have access to politicians to talk about and seeking to move them on.
You know what I wish, Kanisha and Jay, that in this whole series of debates that are about to occur within the, among Democrats and the ones that went on and on with Republicans, I wish, I know the policies, voters think that's what's really important to them. I'm not so sure they vote on the policies the way they say they do, but
right.
I wish we had some forum about character. There was some way to really test the character of the candidate. Forget it. It could never happen. I just feel like that would be so revealing and important.
Yeah, I know. I think it would certainly be a valuable tool. I just wonder sort of the mechanism to do that. It's interesting. If you look at the polling data on the individual that you trust the most to govern or the person you admire the most or their character, I think, and oftentimes, that changes based on your ideological vantage point. And
for sure.
So sometimes I think it's just a very difficult thing to gauge. While I see real value in that, I think it's tough, particularly when voters, to Kanisha's point earlier, that there's a series of issues, people align on political parties increasingly on single or dual issues, and that's the issue, even if they may or may not agree with the myriad other issues. So
right.
For evangelical Christians, Anglo-evangelical Christians, they aligned with Republicans and in particular voted for Trump this cycle entirely because of issues related to the court, abortion rights, religious liberty support in general. And they cared less about other issues like the wall and others. You had a similar set of folks that didn't care about those issues but supported gun rights. You had another set that supported, may have supported Israel or defense spending, depending on your perspective. So I think sometimes it's hard because we want our politicians to do things that we ourselves are unwilling to do, which is compromise on the kind
That's
of
right.
candidate we will support, because they're not saying what we value, that single issue that's most important to us. And we all have different ones that we support.
Yeah. Kanisha, just real quick here, because we've got to close in a minute. But I think that's what happens in places like Kansas and Wisconsin, where the politics kind of turn upside down, where you see union members supporting a candidate who might not look to represent their interests, right?
Yeah, I think as a person who studies race in America, something a bit more nefarious is happening as well, right? As I see it, I'll say. And I think that folks are doing things that don't represent their interests because their interests are not all equal. Their interests are ranked.
Right.
And in the case
right.
of Donald Trump this year, race was an important thing that we didn't get to talk about here, but that folks made decisions about too.
Right. Hey, come back, both of you. This was really a great conversation. Kanisha, thanks much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Jay, thank you. Really good to have you from Texas this morning. Thank you. Again, if you missed the conversation starting out with the political junkie, Ken Rudin, find it on the podcast always.
You just heard a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to the discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet us at @CarrieNPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all our shows by subscribing to this podcast. You can send us your questions or comments by emailing talk@npr.org.